Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. You know, these political conventions, at least for the past few decades, several decades, have been totally scripted in order to be television infomercials for whatever party happens to be throwing it. Well, John Edwards, Hurricane Gustav, and Bristol Palin rewrote the script, or at least Bristol Palin's boyfriend. We're here to talk about the Republican National Convention first, and in a subsequent broadcast, we'll be talking about the Democratic National Convention and the future of the campaign. And Dr. Rob McDaniel, who is an associate professor of political science, is here with us to help sort out the hoopla and separate the stagecraft from the statecraft. Welcome.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Hey, same here. If nothing else, the Republicans are coming out of St. Paul with a great deal of energy. This was a party which even fellow Republicans had said was dispirited, down in the dumps, in the doldrums, because after 8 years of George W. Bush, who is now a highly unpopular president, they don't have a heck of a lot to run on. But they're coming out of this convention with a heck of a lot of passion.
I think so. The convention was a mixed bag in some ways, but one thing that they did get out of it was a higher level of enthusiasm than they had coming in. And that's been an issue because there's been an enthusiasm gap so far. That the polls show that Democrats are overwhelmingly enthusiastic about Barack Obama's candidacy, and Republicans aren't really so sure about their guy. They don't really trust his loyalty because of a window of time between, say, 1999 and 2004, where he struck out some independent positions and occasionally worked with Democrats. And that's really, you know, disappeared over the last 4 years, where he's become a much more loyal Republican, a much more consistent follower of the Bush party line. But Republicans are elephants and they have long memories. And because of that, they needed a shot in the arm. And they seem to get a little bit of one from especially Wednesday night with the Sarah Palin speech. But we'll see how long it lasts. I'm not sure that the feeling that they'll have once last night and the entire week sinks in will be quite as strong as it seems in the heat of the moment.
What do you think about the choice of Palin? She's already being scrutinized. The media are collectively being hammered by fellow Republicans, some of whom are even women, for scrutinizing her, saying that some of the questions she's getting or some of the questions Republicans are getting about her are sexist in nature. And she hasn't really made any her debut really was that Wednesday night speech. She hasn't really made any public appearances to speak of, let alone a press conference.
I think the notion that she's getting questions that's sexist is just silly. I mean, this is just extraordinary. I mean, it's the kind of identity politics that Republicans would blast Democrats for playing, suggesting that any kind of critical scrutiny of somebody who's going to be in a presidential ticket amounts to sexism, when this is somebody who nobody had really heard of before a week ago, who has very little record of public service. And so as a result of that, there's going to be a lot of media attention. There are going to be questions. And the questions that she's gotten aren't any different from the questions that anybody else has gotten.
The Republicans invited this, in fact, by picking a relative unknown, did they not?
Well, that's right. I mean, that's what happens. You know, pick somebody that nobody's ever heard of before and who has a somewhat unusual background. And people are going to start pressing around, especially when it looks like and the New York Times has reported this, that the McCain campaign didn't actually vet her. They didn't really do much research at all. They didn't know much about her background, either her politics or her personal life. The McCain campaign, of course, said that they did vet her. But when you looked at Alaska and people in Alaska, nobody in Alaska had been talked to. Her hometown newspaper, nobody had gone up there from the McCain campaign to look through the archives. Nobody had talked to Republican leaders in the legislature or in the business community. Nobody had talked to journalists or to Democrats. It was really just extraordinary. And because of that, the national media has been playing catch up. Let's figure out who this person is, because the McCain camp doesn't even really seem to know who this person is. And that's just a subject of I think, natural fascination.
Did you expect her speech to be as snarky as it was? I mean, Fred Thompson and Rudy Giuliani threw a lot of red meat out there to the base, but she seemed to be sticking a lot more jabs in at the Democrats.
You know, I wasn't that surprised. I think that from what we know about Governor Palin, she was picked in order to pacify the far right wing of the Republican Party. From reports again in the New York Times, John McCain wanted to pick Joe Lieberman, the independent former Democrat from Connecticut, as his VP. Karl Rove went and told McCain, "You can't do it. He's pro-choice. He's not even officially a Republican, and the convention will revolt." John McCain then wanted Tom Ridge, very popular former governor of Pennsylvania. Former Secretary of Homeland Security, who's close friends with McCain, but who's also pro-choice. And Rove said that won't fly either. And so in a sort of act of desperation, McCain decided, well, we'll go with the woman from Alaska because that'll make the right-wing base very happy because she's a culture warrior. She has impeccable right-wing credentials on abortion and gay marriage and all of those values issues that really gin up the base. She's sort of an Ann Coulter figure in some ways. And so, you know, I think given all of that, it wasn't very surprising that she went out and took that attack dog approach, especially given that that's a pretty typical vice presidential role. But it's a problematic pick for I think, three key reasons. If you think about the McCain campaign to this point, there are three key themes of that campaign. First, foreign policy experience.
Which he has in abundance.
That's right, which he has in abundance.
But she does not.
That's right. She has no foreign policy experience at all. And Republicans have tried to say that she does have foreign policy experience because Alaska is near Russia.
I've heard that.
They've tried to say that she does because she, as governor, she was commander-in-chief of the Alaska National Guard, even though we know that the governor doesn't really make any command decisions in a military capacity, that only is an issue if there's a natural disaster in the state, and there haven't been any in Alaska during her tenure.
The National Guard has to be actualized in a state at the federal level, does it not, in fact? I mean, isn't that what Eisenhower did in Little Rock? He was the one who had to call out the National Guard.
Well, that's right. And so, you know, the idea that these things give her foreign policy credentials is absurd. Now, other people have gotten nominations before without having a lot of foreign policy credentials. It's not the end of the world. But the idea that she is somehow this great, right, this candidate of extraordinary qualifications in national security, or that somehow she's got more than Obama, who's been in the Senate and served in the Foreign Relations Committee and traveled the world and who's been vetted over 19 months of a campaign, answering all kinds of questions, standing up in debates and so on. It just is silly, and they shouldn't have even tried to defend her on those grounds. This was an ideological pick. It was a pick designed to appeal to those Republicans who think that Bush and McCain are too moderate. It's designed to appeal to the Republicans who believe that the problem with the country is that we haven't gone far enough to the right over the last 8 years, and we need somebody who is a passionate and uncompromising advocate for that position.
But is ginning up the culture wars again, as it has happened in the past, going to work when people are concerned about the price of gasoline, the price of food, whether or not they're going to be able to keep their homes? Is the bumper sticker really not, it's the economy, stupid, and people are going to say, you know, abortion, gay rights, okay, back burner, at least this time around?
That's what I expect. I mean, I would be very surprised if this election swung on the culture war issues that she is known for. It seems to me that those, you know, the lunch pail issues, the kitchen counter issues are what really matter to voters. And it was really shocking to me how little Republicans talked about that this week. John McCain made some very brief and halting effort to compensate for that last night.
A couple of targeted references to people in Michigan and Pennsylvania, which are, you know, key states.
That's right. But, you know, if you look at what he said, though, he mentioned people who he'd like to help, But he didn't give you any sense for what they needed and how he was going to address what those concerns were.
And he got a bad reaction from some people in the crowd when he started talking about it, as if there was a segment of the delegates who thought, who agreed with Phil Graham that the recession really is just a figment of your imagination.
That's right. In fact, Fred Thompson's speech earlier in the convention very much picked up on that Phil Graham sensibility, right? The economy's great. Everything's working out really well. And to hear Democrats talk about it, you'd think we're in the Great Depression. Fred Thompson really belittled, I think, people's concerns about the economy in that speech. And I think that that's a problem for John McCain. It doesn't really look like he understands the seriousness of the economic situation. And part of the problem is that John McCain in the Senate was a strong backer of the deregulation of the financial markets that has been one of the major causes of this current situation. And so he doesn't really have a position of strength to stand on. And you know, this is not an issue that he's ever really focused much on in the Senate, aside from pretty standard Republican positions on deregulation and low taxes. He embarrassingly admitted several months back that he didn't really know much of anything about economics and he'd probably have to study up. I think he regrets having said that, because running for president, you never want to make that kind of admission, even if it's true.
Yeah.
But there's something to that. And so as much as possible, he's tried to turn the debate toward judgment in matters of foreign policy and support for the surge, and things like that, and patriotism, right? Which is, experience is his first theme, patriotism is his second theme, and that is a good theme for him. I mean, it's really the one really resonant theme that I think that he's got this year. But again, that's another theme that's undermined in some ways by picking Sarah Palin, because we now know that she has these long-standing affiliations to an Alaska secessionist group that has fairly radical views that are anti-American and anti-constitutional. And, we don't know how direct her involvement is at this point. We know that her husband was a member of the party for almost a decade, and that she did a videotape greeting for their 2008 convention in which she was very complimentary to them. But this is one of the things that we still have to find out about who she is. And so, once again, much as with the experience case, with the patriotism issue, the Sarah Palin pick in some ways steps on that message. And I don't know that that's hurt him yet, because we don't know that much about that yet. But if there are other revelations out there on the horizon, this could be a big, big problem.
How can you be a secessionist when you're in the party of Lincoln?
That's right. It's a great irony. The party of Lincoln nominates a secessionist vice presidential candidate. And she's got to address this. This is a serious question that she's got to answer some questions about. And right now it looks like they're sequestering her, that they're going to protect her from any press questionings. The only interview she's given to this point has been People magazine, right? The celebrity outlet, which is another irony, because the McCain campaign has blasted Obama for trying to be a celebrity, and yet they only let her talk to People magazine.
And yet maybe they picked her because they needed their own rock star.
I think that's it. I think that they have Obama envy. and think about this in terms of another theme of that convention, which is that Obama is the false messiah.
Yeah.
And the Democrats never claimed that Obama was a messiah, but Republicans hit this over and over and over again. And in some ways, I thought what was most interesting about the last couple of nights of this convention was the theme that that John McCain is a kind of American Christ, that he suffered for our sins.
Uh-huh.
He went to hell. And notice that every time they talked about the Hanoi Hilton and his time as a POW, they called it hell. And then they said that he rose again from the dead, and having suffered for us. And he, in his own speech, he said he's got scars.
Yeah.
Right. And if you looked behind him, the backdrop was this heavenly blue sky, and against it set a flagpole, which seemed to resemble in some ways a cross, a crucifix. Right. Mm-hmm. He's been crucified under the flag of his nation. He suffered for us, and we owe this to him. It is a blood atonement. And so, this is interesting. And so, if you've got your American Christ, John McCain, who suffered in very valiant ways, and I think everybody admires what McCain did in Vietnam, but you've got to have a false messiah. You've got to have somebody on the other side who is a poser, who doesn't deserve this kind of attention. And so they have to inflate Obama and Obamamania into something cult-like in order to justify their own position on this.
Yeah.
And yet, ironically, they pick somebody like Sarah Palin, who within the space of a few days has developed this rapturous cult of personality within the Republican Party.
The
and so it's a
cult
of
hockey momism.
Yeah, the cult of hockey momism. It's been really entertaining. I mean, it's the Sarah Palin pick, while fraught with contradictions, certainly made things fun, I think,
yes.
For a change.
It made politics good theater and good television. Both conventions did, which is, you know, a first in a long, long time. And maybe that in and of itself is a healthy thing. I mean, it may have some negative aspects, so we'll see. But you were on a three-pronged track, and I distracted you. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, I think the first prong was experience in foreign policy. The second is patriotism. And the third is that he's a maverick. But, you know, you're not really a maverick when you pander to the right wing of the Republican Party. I mean, I think that that's what we've had for 8 years now. And I think that voters are probably a little bit tired out of that.
Certainly,
and he clearly caved into Karl Rove on this, too. I mean, I don't think that you establish maverick credentials by caving into Karl Rove on your vice presidential pick.
Or by, in the last few years, whereas he had been calling right-wing evangelicals the agents of intolerance, he had been trying to make up to them by going to speak at Jerry Falwell's University and Bob Jones University and so forth and so on, all of which is a way of trying to get back in good with the so-called values voters leading up. With, you know, maybe the apex of that was his picking Sarah Palin.
I think that's exactly right, because those are exactly the voters that he wanted to go to. And the Christology in the thematics of the convention played to that. And, you know, she belongs to a very radical Pentecostal church in Alaska. And her speech had some of the cadences of that you know, Pentecostal sensibility. And it brought back a kind of religious resonance that Republicans always look for, or at least recent Republicans have tended to look for, but had been missing from this. McCain is one of the most secular Republicans that we've seen in a long time, not very comfortable talking about issues of faith. And so they really thought they needed to shore that up, especially because Barack Obama has been reaching out to faith communities and evangelicals in ways that you don't normally expect Democrats to do. Now, I don't know that he's going to get that many votes from that community. I think he's hoping at most just to cut into Bush's margin a little bit by getting some independent-minded evangelicals who are concerned with environmental issues and stewardship of the earth and these sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
But McCain, I think, effectively struck back on that. And the Palin pick was very good from a base mobilization strategy. The initial polls, I think, I haven't seen polls from after McCain's speech, but the initial polls after Palin's pick suggested that she did help him with the conservative base, that he picked up points there, although Obama picked up a little bit more from Hillary supporters and from especially independent women. And one of the things that I think has been most interesting with the polls that we've seen so far is that the reaction of women toward Sarah Palin has been much more hostile than the reaction of men.
Because they feel that they were intelligence was insulted because there was a pick of a woman to be on the ticket, and they believe that the people who made this decision assumed that just because they picked a woman to be on the ticket and they didn't get their way with Hillary breaking the glass ceiling, that they would immediately vote for a woman just because she's a woman, never mind the issues.
That's right, and I think it looked like a stunt. And one without a lot of credibility. And McCain is running on his credibility and his judgment, and so that's again a problem. And this came out, you know, you may have heard about this. There was what is now becoming a famous open mic incident on MSNBC on Wednesday.
It's even on
Sarah
YouTube
Palin's
now.
Speech. Yeah, even on YouTube now, where Chuck Todd from MSNBC had Peggy Noonan, the prominent Republican advisor and columnist, and Mike Murphy, a longtime friend of John McCain and former advisor to John McCain, talking about the Palin pick. And when they thought that the mic had was stopped rolling and that the cameras were off, they started talking candidly about what they thought. And Mike Murphy and Peggy Noonan both started blasting that pick as insane. Peggy Noonan said, "It's over. This race is done. Obama has won it," is effectively what she said, by this pick of Sarah Palin. And what they both tended to argue was that, you know, the Republicans who know how to win elections know that you pick a moderate from a swing state. You pick a guy like you know, John Engler, the former governor of Michigan, or Tommy Thompson from Wisconsin, or in this race, Tom Ridge. I mean, I really think Tom Ridge was far and away the best vice presidential pick for John McCain. He's the one who has the best foreign policy credentials among that crowd. He's former governor of a swing state, very likable guy who can reach out to moderates and independents and so on.
And after I saw Tim Pawlenty's speech, I know why they didn't pick him, because it was Sominek's does a better job. Nice guy, but not scintillating speech.
I think that's right. I mean, he would have been a horrible pick, and it would have been a safe pick. And this is part of McCain's problem. McCain didn't have a lot of good options going in for vice president. There weren't people out there who were natural selections. I think Ridge was the best, but again, Ridge was pro-choice. And the Republican convention, for them, that is an absolute deal breaker. Even in a vice presidential candidate, that cannot be allowed. And so because of that, McCain had to go with something just much, much riskier. Tim Pawlenty would have been a safer pick. I mean, I don't think that Tim Pawlenty would have embarrassed John McCain in any way. But nobody really would have been excited about Tim Pawlenty. He's not a dramatic choice. He's not a scintillating speaker.
He would still have an identity problem. You still have to explain to the nation who he is.
That's right. He's relatively unknown. I mean, I think he's more experienced than Governor Palin is, and a little bit better known than she is. And, you know, had been mentioned as one of the people on the short list for a long time. And so we actually started to look into his record a little bit and find out some things about him. And you know, he seems like a very nice and a guy with a sense of humor and kind of Midwestern decency about him. But, McCain felt that he was losing this race, that all things being equal, with Bush's approval ratings below 30% by some polls and the economy not looking very good, that he needed a game changer. He needed somebody who could seize the narrative and make a big impression with the media. And so, again, this is one of the ironies of this campaign. She was picked because she would make a huge impact with the media. And now when the media is starting to ask some critical questions and they're not sure that that impact is a good impact, they want to protect her as much as possible and prevent her from having to face any real questioning.
And the media have fallen out of love with John McCain after having been criticized and flagellating themselves to a certain extent for having been his best buddies on the Straight Talk Express after that prickly interview he gave to Jay Carney of Time magazine, in which he gave basically one and two word answers and said, "Haven't you read my books?" to some very softball questions. The media are not infatuated with this man anymore.
Well, you know, John McCain famously refers to the media as his base. Mm-hmm. I mean, no politician in modern American politics over the last couple of decades has been more beloved and really loved by the media in America than John McCain. He is the original celebrity candidate. He appears on those talking head shows more than anybody else, except, I mean, I think the only competitor he has is Joe Biden, interestingly enough. And
Joe loves to talk, but we'll talk about the Democrats later.
That's right. But, you know, with McCain, there has been a falling away, that he's lost people like Howard Feinman at Newsweek and Joe Klein at Time magazine. One of his spokesmen got really flustered by questioning from Campbell Brown of CNN, who's married to a prominent Republican activist and operative in the Bush administration, a guy named Dan Senor. And,
yeah.
And so, you know, you're seeing this coming from strange places. Andrea Mitchell, who's, I think a Republican in good standing and married to Alan Greenspan. And, you know, she's at times been, I think, shocked at some of the things that the McCain campaign has said. And so there are still elements of the media crush out there. I mean, Chris Matthews still really has something of a bromance going with John McCain, and will at times gush about his affection for McCain. And there are others who do too. And I think Cokie Roberts is another example of a very establishment Washington person who still really just adores John McCain. But there are cracks in that relationship. And you know, people like Joe Klein and Howard Feinman and Andrea Mitchell and Campbell Brown, I think, are signs of that.
With regard to the Maverick angle, did you notice the degree to which Teddy Roosevelt's name and image were integrated into the campaign? And Teddy Roosevelt is a Republican that I usually only hear brought up by Democrats when they talk about the kind of Republicans they wish Republicans were.
Well, there's a moment when that meant something. I mean, I think that, you know, McCain in 2000 was in some ways a very Teddy Roosevelt kind of candidate. He was trying to reestablish the Republican coalition on new grounds. The McCain's calculation in 2000 was that the old Reagan Republicanism had petered out, that it had lost its energy, that the Cold War was over, and that the grounding rationale of Reagan conservatism, which in some ways was anti-communism, wasn't going to work as the glue for a coalition, and he needed something else. And he looked to Teddy Roosevelt as a model, a kind of populist, reform-minded conservatism that took on the special interests, that fought the big fights, that was genuinely concerned about corruption in politics.
And was a warrior who charged up San Juan Hill.
And was a warrior who charged up San Juan Hill. And you know, I think it worked in 2000. And McCain in 2000 really, for me at least, was the most interesting and dynamic presence in that campaign. And a lot of us have very nostalgic feelings about McCain in 2000. And of course, the media, I think, does too, because McCain really did run as a different kind of Republican that year.
He really was kicking his own party's butt back then.
That's right. And I think that he maintained that for another 3 years after that. That in the first 3 years in the Senate after Bush took office, McCain really was the leader of the opposition to Bush. But what happened, and it hasn't been reported very much, but what happened was clearly this. In 2004, McCain had to decide what his future was going to be. And he actually called up John Kerry personally and initiated a series of, I think, 7 phone conversations where they discussed McCain being Kerry's vice president. And I think what McCain eventually did was come to the realization that if he did that, if he joined that ticket, he would never get his own shot at the presidency because he would be too old and he wouldn't have a party base.
Reference Joe Lieberman.
That's exactly right. And so what he did was he immediately did a U-turn, and he decided the only way he was going to have a shot was to wrap himself around George Bush. And so that's when, in the middle of 2004, very shortly after he's been negotiating with John Kerry to be John Kerry's vice president, we see pictures of him hugging Bush around the waist. And, you know, then we see the pictures later when Katrina hits New Orleans, he and Bush are laughing it up and eating cake for John McCain's birthday. And, you know, all of these, right, he wraps himself around this and he very much tries to start ingratiating himself to the base. He changes. He essentially drops most of his reform agenda and tries to become a more conventional Bush Republican so that he can win a Republican primary. And as a result of that, John McCain really hasn't been the same John McCain that over the last 4 years that he was for the 4 or 5 years before that. And I miss that. I miss the old John McCain. And I thought he tried to get a little bit of that back last night. And he tried, you know, referencing Teddy Roosevelt was a way of trying to say, listen, I'm still that same old guy that you loved back in the day. But when you do that after a convention that just is relentlessly negative and these very bitter attacks against Barack Obama and accusations against his motives and against his patriotism, and, you know, it just doesn't, I don't think it's not a very credible move, because it's not as if these people were acting on their own. Their speeches were crafted by the McCain campaign. They were designed to reinforce his connections to Bush in a whole range of ways to reassure delegates. And John McCain just can't come in at the very last moment and say, oh, but I'm a bipartisan. I'm not old McCain that you loved back in the day.
Now that the convention is over, how do McCain and Palin best position themselves as they go out on the campaign trail? What is the best way from their point of view, from the party's point of view, that they can position themselves?
You know, that's a really good question. And I think what they have to do is they have to find a way to talk about those kitchen table kinds of issues and economics that they've really failed to talk about so far. And part of the problem is that in order to ingratiate himself to the Bush Republicans and the Bush base, John McCain had to abandon his earlier principled stands against the Bush tax cuts. And not only did he endorse now the Bush tax cuts and making them permanent, he's doubled down on that by demanding even more tax cuts, again, aggressively targeted toward the wealthiest Americans. Because of that, he doesn't really have a lot that he can do. You know, that by, you know, most estimates, the McCain tax cuts are going to blow a big hole in the deficit. And the national debt, particularly over the next 10 years. The Brookings Institute estimates that McCain's tax cut plans would add $4.2 trillion to the national debt over the next 10 years.
And the Brookings Institution ain't liberal.
No, I mean, there's a time when they were, but now they're a very centrist kind of establishment-oriented think tank, and so this is not a partisan operation. And so McCain is once again, I mean, much like Bush, promising tax cuts aimed at the wealthy that are so huge that it prevents him from being able to really do anything else that goes to the concerns of middle American voters, I think.
No offense to John McCain and Sarah Palin, but the last maverick I fell in love with was James Garner, and he's not running for president. I'm sorry. Rob McDaniel, thank you for being with us today, and we'll be talking about the Democrats a week from the air date of this program. Thank you.
Thanks, Jenna.
This is MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again next Sunday at the same time. Also, you can check us out at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.